It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When we talk about public schools, education is on the list, but it is just one of many items on that list. Test scores are on the list. Teacher salaries are on the list. So is legislation from the General Assembly governing teacher pay, teacher assistance, third grade reading requirements, and more. And this year in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, there are school bonds that will be on this November's ballot, $290 million in bonds. They are also on the list of things to talk about when it comes to public education, and we're going to talk about most of these items this hour with the superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, Dr. Heath Morrison, who has just gotten off a flight from San Diego. You took the red eye to be on this show. Welcome back.
I was not going to miss it and have an opportunity to talk to you, so of course it was worth taking a red eye.
Well, we'll try to keep you awake. We'll ply you with coffee here.
There you go. I'm all good.
Let's start with the bonds, $290 million. On the ballot in November for 17 capital projects, and you've called the need for the money that would come from these bonds real and urgent.
Yes.
Why?
Well, when you look at capital needs in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District, we're one of the largest school districts in the country, and our overall total needs in terms of our capital plan is in excess of $1.8 billion. So our county commissioners made available $290 million in a bond referendum. When you compare that to other school districts that are comparable in our size, Wake County is going to the voters today for a $900 million bond referendum. Houston Unified School District in Texas, a little larger than we are, but not much, last year got approved a $1.7 billion bond referendum. Montgomery County, Maryland, which is the same size as Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, recently got a $1.4 billion bond referendum passed. And so in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District, when you think about why would you need to look at your facilities, and primarily school districts look at the need to add to their facility or upgrade facilities for two reasons. You either have aging facilities, and you want to make sure that they're safe and welcoming for education, and then also if you're growing in population. So let's start with there. Over the last 5 years prior to this year, we have grown over 10,000 students. And so we continue to see growth, and so therefore you continue to need to have additional space for those students. And then this year, though we're still waiting for the state to allow us to verify the exact number through their new student information system, we will have grown an additional 3,000 students this year. So that's 13,000 students in the last 6 years. With the situation with our facilities, about 50% of our facilities in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District are either close to, at, or older than 50 years old. So we have done a very good job of upkeeping those schools, maintaining them. But like any of our facilities, you might love your home, but after 50 years, there's some upgrades that you need to make. So with our bond referendum, we have an opportunity to build some new schools, to replace some very aging facilities, add programs like career technology, magnet programs that will help us be more workforce ready. And so we're excited about going out to the voters and letting them know why this is important.
When's the last time we had school bonds on the ballot?
The last time was in 2007, and that was a successful bond referendum, and we are very grateful to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg community for voting to approve those bonds.
And you threw out all these numbers from Montgomery County and Houston, Texas, and other places where they had billion-dollar bond referendums that passed, and we're talking about, in comparison to that, a paltry $290 million.
I would never say $290 million is paltry, but when people say, is that a lot of money? And I say, well, I think $290 million is certainly a lot of money, but in comparison to other school districts our size, I think it's important to put that scale out there, but also to look at just one high school today. To build one new comprehensive high school can be around $80 million. So it's, the fact that the $290 million that we have in this bond referendum is going to hit 17 capital projects that will actually touch about 29 schools.
Were their needs in these other districts with these billion-dollar bond referendums greater than ours? Did they put jewelry in the schools? I mean, what's the difference between their need for a billion and our request for $290 million?
Well, I think when you look at each one, the similar situation as we have, aging facilities, the need to upgrade those structures with technology, growing school districts. So I think they're the similar needs. I don't think that they were any more in need. They had the opportunity, and I'm very happy for them. I know all those superintendents and school districts very well, so I'm happy for what they were able to go out and ask for. And we're grateful that the county commissioners were able to make $290 million available and a similar figure for the community college. And we are very supportive of our community college as well. So were those districts more in need than we were? Absolutely not. But we have $290 million to ask for, and that's what we're going to move forward with.
Every time we talk about bonds, whether they're for the schools or for roads, I like to talk about how they work a little bit, because a lot of people just don't follow this and don't know much about it. We are told that taxes, and on your literature that you put out to voters, you say no tax increase related to bond vote. In other words, our taxes will not go up if you vote yes on these bonds, but the money has to be paid back. Where does it come from?
Yeah, so the way that the county commissioners and their staff structured this particular bond referendum, they have identified a number of different ways that they will pay for capital construction projects, both for the community college if the bond referendum passes, the school district, and then also some of the other obligations that they will have. So there's a variety of different ways, but they've actually already allocated those monies in anticipation of if the bond referendum passes. So there won't be any need to increase the tax rate. And I think that's part of the reason why it was $290 million as opposed to additional money. There was a desire on the part of our county commissioners not to have to raise taxes in order to pay for these bonds. So the money is basically allocated for in their budgeting cycle. But what they have to do is, of course, have the permission of our citizens to move forward. So,
and the bonds aren't issued until the construction actually begins. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and that always causes a little sense of confusion. So, for example, in 2007, the voters were very grateful, and Mecklenburg County moved forward with a bond referendum for the school district. And so we're asked, well, have those projects been finished? And they are almost finished, but there are still some projects left. And so people are like, well, why haven't you all finished? That was passed in 2007. Well, we have to wait. You know, the first step is for the voters to approve the bond referendum, and that happened in 2007. And then the county has to allocate the dollars on a schedule. So it's not like you get all the money at once. They allocate it on a schedule. And, of course, in 2007, what happened was about 2008, 2009, the recession happened. So the county had to scale back on the issuance of the bonds. But what I'm proud of in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools is every time bond money has been released and we've been able to move forward on our projects, every project in the 2007 bond referendum has come in on time and under budget. And actually, our cost of construction is lower than the counties and lower than the states. And so, you know, we're proud of when we get the money released, we move aggressively on it, and we've done some good things. And that's why this 2013 bond referendum is so important.
Why is your cost of construction lower than the county and the states? What are you doing differently?
Well, I think there's a number of things that we have the ability to do. We have, obviously, there's scale for us. In the 2007 bond projects, we had a number of different projects, and so we were able to utilize a number of different companies. We were able to schedule things in a way that makes sense in terms of if we do this project, we can then move forward on another project. And then, some of the things that I'm really proud of that we've done in our school district is we've standardized a lot of our school construction. So a big part of any kind of construction project is the design. And so we have standardized the designs for many of our schools, especially at the elementary and middle school level.
That's interesting, because back in the day when we were talking about not being able to keep up with the growth in the school system prior to the recession, people would call this program, when we were talking about bond issues, and say, why does every school have to be different? Why can't you have one plan for elementary, one plan for high school, et cetera, and if it needs to be slightly bigger, you just modularize it and make it slightly bigger? And what you're doing is exactly that.
That's exactly what we're doing. And so when you see some of our schools, I mean, there will be little differences in the interior, you know, obviously as they select a mascot and select colors that will look a little bit different. But you'll see a lot of uniformity in terms of the way our schools look, and that allows us to cut down on the design costs.
So taxes won't increase as a result of saying yes to the $290 million in bonds, but it's that's the total cost for the 17 existing projects that you're proposing in the capital bond request is $295.2 million, with the $290 coming from the bond request, $5.2 million to be covered by the county using other sources. What other sources?
The county has a number of different sources. One of the ones I believe that they utilize is called PAYGO. So they budget for it in their annual operating budget, so they're actually not having to use bond money. Mm-hmm. They tend to pay for a lot of their projects using PAYGO.
Makes things cheaper.
You'd have to ask the county manager on that.
I'm actually telling you that because I've asked the county manager about that. It makes things cheaper because we're not paying for the money that we're borrowing.
And I think that's probably part of the reason why they have gone to that very aggressively.
Okay. CMS says the bonds will provide more, and you've already talked about this, more academic options for students, relieve overcrowding, provide for renovation and replacements of various facilities. The academic options. You're saying that the passage of these bonds will increase access to high-demand programs and magnets that prepare today's students for tomorrow's workforce in areas like science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. Give me some examples.
Yeah, well, so it's not only the academic offerings I'm proud of. We really try to think out of the box with this bond referendum. So, for example, as we looked at needing to address overcrowding in a lot of schools, we thought, okay, well, we need an elementary and a middle school. So we started to know when we knew that it would probably be not a bond referendum to exceed $300 million, we started to say, okay, how can we still address these needs, do some great things academically, but address the fact that we won't be able to build an elementary and a middle school? So in this bond referendum, we have several K-8 STEAM magnets. And so STEAM is science, technology, engineering, arts, and the math, because in the workforce of tomorrow, creativity is so important, and you get that through the arts. So we have several K-8 magnet programs that will address overcrowding in several different schools. And by building a K-8, you don't need to build an elementary and a middle school. So we have a K-8 around the Albemarle Road area. We have a K-8 in concept in the Ballantyne area. And so this is going to allow choice. It's going to allow options for a number of different schools and alleviate overcrowding in more than just one school.
We've heard a lot in recent years about STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. I've never heard the term STEAM until this morning, and STEAM, the A in that, as you says, is arts, but usually when times get tough, arts, music education, art in the classroom, theater, etc., that's the first thing to go. Is this a new what's the word I'm looking for? Is this a new point of view now? Are you saying this is not going to be the first thing to go anymore?
Well, you know, I'm proud of the fact that having done two budgets in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, we have not cut back at all our commitment to the arts. As a matter of fact, one of the projects in this bond referendum is for a new auditorium facility at Northwest School of the Arts. Mm-hmm. And we're very proud of the great work happening at that school. What I know is we have been looking at not only our capital plans, but our evolving strategic plan. We are as focused, I would challenge anyone to find a school district that is more focused in terms of workforce development, not only for now, but for the Charlotte-Mecklenburg region in the future. And in the future, what is going to be different for our children, for our young adults as they enter the workplace, is unlike us, when we went looking for a job, they will have to create their own job. And so what the futurists and demographers and are saying in terms of workforce development now and in the near future is that you're going to bring great creativity, innovation, entrepreneurship to the workplace. And mm-hmm. so we believe that one of the best ways for students to get that creativity, that innovation, is through the arts. So we think the science, technology, engineering, and math of STEM is very important. But when you add the A to it, it allows for that total experience for the student, which we think is so important.
Is that a hard sell?
No, it's not. I will tell you, as we go out, our communities love it. We've had a number of requests for schools to add more STEAM, not just STEM, programs to their concepts and to what they're already offering. And so it is, as a matter of fact, the challenge is there's so much demand for it that we wish we could be even more aggressive with putting more out there.
Dr. Heath Morris is our guest, superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. We're talking about the bonds, but we'll be talking about other things with regard to the schools as well as we go through this hour. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about how why we need to alleviate overcrowding by building new buildings, because the traditional way that we've done it in Mecklenburg County, at least, is to add more mobile classrooms. We'll talk about that and more things in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and executive MBA programs at UNC Keenan Flagler for working professionals, hosting a weekend MBA open house in Chapel Hill Saturday. Registration, emba.unc.edu. And the 66th Annual Craft Fair of the Southern Highlands, presenting works from 200 juried artists at U.S. Cellular Center in Asheville, October 17th through 20th. Details at craftguild.org. Wynton Marsalis founded Jazz at Lincoln Center, and tonight he brings that jazz to Charlotte, but tomorrow he joins us to talk about the importance of music and of music education and about growing up in the first family of American jazz. He says that jazz places a premium on originality and individuality, and his personal style won him the Pulitzer Prize for Music. Wynton Marsalis, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, more than 8 million Americans tried to shop for insurance last week on the new Affordable Care Exchanges. Strong interest, technical glitches, and other rollout challenges.
Join Diane Rehm for that conversation this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Heath Morrison, Superintendent of Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, our guest today. We're talking about all things education, and we've started out with the $290 million in school bonds that will be on the November ballot for 17 capital projects, which would help relieve overcrowding, provide new schools in additions to accommodate student population growth, which is up about 13,000 projected from 5 years ago next year, because you're 10,000 plus 3,000,
right?
And reduce the need for mobile classrooms. How many schools are involved in all these different projects that you're talking about, these 17 projects?
Well, the 17 projects will alleviate overcrowding or address needs that actually will touch about 29 schools. So again, what we tried to do was, once we knew the bond capacity would be around $300 million, we really started to think about how could we stretch those dollars, again, do more than just alleviate one school. And so that was really the concept behind some of these K-8 magnet programs, was that you would not only be able to address overcrowding at some of the schools that are most impacted, but even some of the surrounding schools. So in the south, around the Ballantyne area, right, lots of overcrowding around the eastern part of our county, around Albemarle Road Elementary and Middle School, tremendous amount of overcrowding. And so we're excited about the fact that, again, by not having to build an elementary and a middle school, building a K-8, making it magnet, partial magnet or a full magnet, we will be able to touch more than just 17 projects. It'll actually impact 29 schools.
And you're also repurposing some schools, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
how does that involve money?
Well, because what you have to do is, there's some when some of the schools were closed several years ago, they were converted to office spaces. And so there's a need to now convert them back for instructional purposes, put technology back in there.
Why did we do that in the first place then? If we knew most likely that they'd have to become schools again, why did we convert them only to have to reconvert them?
Well, I think at the time there was not a need for some of these schools. And so when you looked at, again, this was several years ago, mm-hmm, there was several of the schools were closed either for lack of enrollment or for performance. And so I think what the county had always said, the school district said, was if there was a need for those schools in the future, that's why they were held on to or repurposed in terms of office spaces. And so as we have looked at our capital needs, what I'm always going to do is, I'm going to first say, what do we have in our inventory? What are the schools that we could make back for student purposes? And then if we can go there first, that's what we'll do, because that will save taxpayers' dollars.
You mentioned that some of the schools in the system are 50 years old. And in fact, your website says that, for instance, Statesville Road Elementary is well beyond its defined life cycle.
Yeah.
Given that the U.S. Capitol building and the White House are nearly 200 years old and still operating, people want to know, how come school buildings have such limited life cycles? I mean, can schools be designed to last?
Yeah, you know, it's when you look at any sort of renovation project, you have to ask a basic question. Is it cheaper to renovate it? You know, and so you watch HGTV and you see a home completely gutted. And sometimes it's easier to renovate and cheaper and more economical, but then sometimes it's actually cheaper to build new. And in the case of, for example, in the original 2007 bond, McClinic Middle School was supposed to be a renovation. It actually was more cost effective and cheaper to build a brand new school. So if you get a chance to go see McClinic Middle School, it is an amazing facility. It is absolutely a great place for our children to learn. And it actually was cheaper to build new than it was to try to renovate the building. And so right now, with the materials cost for construction, it is actually cheaper in many of these cases to build new rather than renovate. So we look at that.
So when you renovate, what are you actually doing? I mean, are you wiring it for the – what are you doing?
There's a number of different things. So, you know, partially you have to look at each school and the unique needs of that school. So sometimes it's a total infrastructure. Sometimes when you look at the building, the way it was designed, it was designed for schools the way they operated 50, 60 years ago. And so there's no opportunity to add the sort of technology that you need for schools today. Other cases, you know, structurally, It is more efficient and cost effective to replace a school. So you have to look at each one. We have projects at South MEC, East MEC, and so those are not new schools. Those are renovations and additions to those schools. And so we look at each and every facility and we try to say, can we keep the core facility? Is it cheaper to renovate? Or in some cases, is it cheaper, more economical to build new?
You're also talking about adding classroom space to eliminate the need for mobile classrooms. And your predecessor, Dr. Peter Gorman, said many times on this program that it didn't matter if a student learned in a school building or a trailer, as long as the teaching, as long as the instruction was good. What's wrong with mobile classrooms? Are they more expensive to keep up? Are they more costly to heat and cool? What's the deal with mobile classrooms?
Well, I certainly think the most important thing is always the quality of the teacher. When I was a high school principal, I was so proud of the faculty that we had put together. And I would say I would take my faculty in a barn before I would take a poor faculty in a beautiful facility. So I think it's always about the teacher and about the quality of the staff. But the buildings are important, too. And what we know about our mobile units, it's not that being in a mobile unit is necessarily a bad thing. But it creates logistical issues and challenges. And certainly as we look at safety, there's a lot of issues around safety with our mobile units in terms of as we have to do shelters in place, as we have to do evacuations for fire drills. There are issues and concerns, especially with having more students in mobiles. So, for example, Albemarle Road Elementary School, which is one of the schools that we desperately need to provide relief for, it's around 1,300 students. There are actually more students in Albemarle Road Elementary School in mobile units than there is inside the brick-and-mortar building. So we're always going to have mobile units. We're never going to be at a point, I believe, in the next 10 to 15 years where we're not going to have mobile units. But when we have the ability to address overcrowding and create schools that will accommodate inside the building, that's always the most preferable way to instruct.
I was telling you before we started this conversation on the air that it's been very quiet at CMS, unlike previous years where you guys were swirling or controversy was swirling around you. I don't know that you were swirling in controversy, but it was swirling around you. And bonds, the bond issues used to create a lot of dissension. Is there any opposition to these bonds?
We're just hearing so much support. Every time I go out to do community meetings, town hall meetings, everywhere I'm going, I'm hearing a lot of support for the bonds. You know, there's always going to be some individuals who have concerns. They're going to go back to things, concerns that they had from several years ago. You know, when I do hear concerns, it's usually about two things. There is a concern that it's going to raise taxes, which is why we're so vocal in making sure that people know it will not raise taxes. And the other part is I often hear, well, they haven't even finished the bonds, capital projects from the 2007 bond campaign. And what we try to explain to people is that is not within our control. We have to wait for the county to release that money. We completely understand why the county commissioners had to slow down the issuance of the bonds that were passed in 2007. And so as people get to know that, they're like, okay, that makes sense. And so I've heard tremendous support, and it's really important for us to continue to educate our public and to make sure people know why these are important, and then hopefully celebrate a very successful bond referendum on November the 6th.
One of the other pieces of opposition that I've heard from, particularly from groups in the north and south of Mecklenburg County, is they question whether there is a need to deal with in this increasing student population at CMS when the laws have changed regarding magnet schools, and there'll be more magnet schools taking the pressure off. Charter schools taking the pressure off of CMS. There's no longer a cap on the number of charter schools, and the number of charters in Mecklenburg County is surging, it seems. 7 opened this year, 9 are scheduled to open next year, 42 want to open the following year, and they provide options for parents, I suppose, but aren't they sucking away, I'm serious about this, aren't they sucking away the lifeblood of public schools?
Well, so let's kind of frame that in a couple of different ways. So I think what's important to remember, there's a difference between charters opening because there's a demand for them, and charters opening because we've made it really easy to open up charters in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And so we have seen a number of charters open up this year. There are 11 scheduled to open next year. I don't believe 11 will open next year. I think less than 11 will open. And the 42 letters of interest are just that, people saying, I have an interest in opening a charter school. That doesn't mean anywhere close to that many will open.
But do you have to fund? Don't you help fund these charter schools? Doesn't the public school system fund it?
So the charter schools are public schools, and so they derive part of their funding, most of their funding from the state, and they will derive part of their funding from the county. So that's absolutely true.
Now, so they're draining money from you, correct?
Well, there is a loss of money if students choose to go to a charter.
So does this make it unsustainable for public schools in the long run?
Well, I think what will make it unsustainable is if there is no examination of the quality and quantity of the charters. I have never been oppositional to charters. As a matter of fact, I have been supportive of charters when they're good quality charters. When I came into town last year, I convened several meetings with our charter schools and private schools so that we can collaborate more together. That had never been done. And so, but what I am concerned about in North Carolina is that we have made it so easy to open up charters. I do question how much quality control goes into the creation of a charter. And then
how many have failed over the years?
There are people better to answer that question than I am.
Because there is a matter of choice. I mean, people do want
Absolutely.
Choice. But they want the choice because they see the public schools as having failed and continuing to fail children in terms of educating them properly.
And that's nice language.
Is that true
some
in
people,
your opinion?
Well, let's talk about that. So in North Carolina, and again, remember, I've only been in North Carolina for 2 years, but I will tell you across the country, North Carolina has been lifted up as a state that got K-12 education right. Right. Not that it was perfect, not that it still didn't need to improve. Of course, it continued to need to improve. But look what's happened in North Carolina the last several years. Rising graduation rates. We've seen that in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. This year, we posted the highest graduation rate we have seen over the last 5 years. And our graduation rates have been going up.
Yes, but can they read?
What's that?
Can they read?
Well, let's look at that. When you look at state mandated testing, we have continued to see increases of reading scores. We have seen a narrowing of the achievement gaps. We've seen more kids in advanced placement courses. When you pull North Carolina's data out of international studies, so if you take North Carolina out of the United States, North Carolina performs comparably to many of the countries that we get told that are outperforming our country. And when you put all that together with the fact that in North Carolina we have funded education in the bottom 50 of states, the return on investment has been very, very strong. And across the country, the brand of North Carolina, K-12 and higher education, has been very strong. So I really take issue when anybody stands up and says, public education is failing in North Carolina, because the proof just doesn't show it.
So
can it get better? Does it need to get better? Absolutely.
So what would you tell the proponents of charter schools?
Well, what I say to the proponents of charter schools is, let's make sure that they're good. Let's make sure that we're working in collaboration. I don't see that it's oppositional. Is it competition? Absolutely, but it doesn't have to be oppositional. But what I'm concerned about is when some of the charters that are opening up in our state have failed miserably in other regions of the country, they are mostly for-profit, when they don't take all kids. And this is something that I'm very focused on. Charter schools are public schools. They are not supposed to be able to pick and choose who they want. They're not supposed to be able to say yes to some families and no to others. They are public schools, and there are some great charter schools, Sugar Creek Charter School, which takes in all students. But there are some other charter schools in our state that are not always as welcoming to all families.
How do they get away with that?
There's a number of different things. First of all, they don't all have to offer transportation and food services. So if you don't have to offer transportation and food services, then automatically you can not have to take poor students.
Right.
And so there's a number of different mechanisms that I think that need to be called into question, because, again, charter schools or public schools, and they should be obligated to serve the entire public.
Do they face the same testing requirements as the public schools, the same third-grade reading requirements, the same caps on teacher pay that the public schools face?
So they have some flexibilities that the traditional public schools do not have. For the most part, they have to take the same tests. But I'll tell you one thing that passed in the legislature the last session was that charter schools only have to have 50% of their teachers certified.
Yeah.
Now people say, why does that matter? Well, they can now have two teachers that they are advertising as certain teachers, but we would have to call one of those teachers a teacher and the other a teacher assistant. But they can call them two teachers because only 50% of their teachers have to be certified. So when you see some of the literature for charter schools and they're advertising 20-2, parents really need to ask, are those certified teachers or are those teachers that have been trained? Or in CMS, would that be a teacher and a teacher assistant?
So clearly the playing field is not completely level. If they took away the restrictions that – if you had the same lack of restrictions in some cases, the same rules to play by that the charter schools have to play by, would you be even in an even better situation?
Well, you know, again –
because there are those who believe that there is a thrust to remove public education from our
– I have to believe that's not the case. Right. And the legislators that I've had the pleasure of working with, I have not – in our Mecklenburg delegation, I have not found that to be the case with any of those individuals. So I have to believe that the laws that are being passed are with the best of intent to improve all public education. But one of the things in Charlotte-Mecklenburg we have been very vocal on and asking for the legislature is to give us the same flexibilities as the charter schools. We don't have to utilize them, but give us those same flexibilities. And then if it's competition, if there's this belief that competition will make us all better, then let's compete.
So how do you plan when you don't know, when you do know that there are more charter schools opening every year,
right,
the lack of caps now, and you don't know how many parents will avail themselves of the opportunity to take their children out of public schools and put them in charter schools? How do you know how many schools you need to renovate or build?
Yeah, it makes it very difficult, which is part of what I've said as well, and that is that when you look at trying to be cost-effective, when you try to be cognizant of judicious use of taxpayer dollars, you want to be as planful as you can. So it puts a lot of uncertainties into those areas. But, you know, one thing, again, when people say that we're having this huge increase of charter schools, there's a difference between people creating charter schools because they have an interest in creating a school versus demand. Remember, even with a number of different charter schools that have opened in the Mecklenburg County over the last several years, we have continued to grow. 13,000 students in the last 6 years. So we are not seeing an exodus for charter schools. I want to continue to work with our local charter schools. We've developed good relationships. I think that's important. But I also want the public to demand quality of all schools, CMS and our charters, and if they exercise the vouchers as well.
We have had some emails and Facebook comments come in as we've been talking about this, which are illustrative of the point that I'm about to make. If I'm a teacher and the legislature has cut my pay steadily, and they've said you're not going to get a raise even if you go for a master's degree. And I'm sitting here listening to the fact that you're asking us for $290 million in bonds to build schools and renovate schools. You're asking to give money to bricks, but I'm not getting any. I'm ticked off.
Yeah.
So tell me why those bonds cannot be used for teacher pay.
That's in every school district, there's two different distinct budgets. There's operating budgets, which pay for your materials of instruction, your teachers.
But that's policy. Why can't the bonds be used for teacher pay?
Because the way that they're structured and the way that they're funded, they cannot be used for your operating dollars. I think more importantly, it's not an either or. There is not, you know, we have to pay teachers, therefore we can't build buildings. There is a need in terms of schools and how we educate students to have facilities, to have technology. Those are things that absolutely are imperative. But it is also absolutely imperative to pay our teachers. And what I'm concerned about is over the last 10 years in North Carolina, we have seen the most precipitous drop in teacher salaries in the entire country, by far. And so now our teachers in North Carolina are paid close to $10,000 below the national average. We are seeing quality teachers leave to go to other states. And this is, I believe it is not only, it is not a Charlotte-Mecklenburg issue, it is a North Carolina issue. It's an economic development issue because without our quality teachers, we are not going to get our future workforce ready to make the kind of regional growth and job creation that everybody wants in our state. So this is it's a moral imperative to take care of our teachers, to support them, and we're just not in a good place right now in our state.
We're coming back to that. We have to take a break. Well, we'll come back to talk more about teacher pay in just a second with Dr. Heath Morrison. He's the CMS superintendent of schools. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Catawba College in Salisbury, serving traditional and adult students since 1851, an education dedicated to personal attention, blending liberal arts with career preparation. Details at catawba.edu. And Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia. Subaru, Love Strikes Twice event in October with a full line of all-wheel drive Subaru vehicles, including the new 2014 Forester and certified pre-owned vehicles. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. More than 8 million Americans tried to shop for insurance last week on the new Affordable Care Exchanges. A look at the program's strong interest, technical glitches, and other rollout challenges in 20 minutes to 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We continue our conversation about all things Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools with Dr. Heath Morrison, and you can join that conversation at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Big day at the job. They're all waiting for you right now in the conference room. Well, they're going to have to wait because you're not leaving the radio until you hear the end of that story. Snap Judgment from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Saturdays at 8 p.m. or Fridays at 10 p.m. on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. Heath Morrison is our guest. I'm Mike Collins. He's the superintendent of Charlotte Mecklenburg Public Schools, and I am not. let's go back to teacher pay. We're asking for $290 million in bonds.
Right.
For capital projects and improvements. While teacher pay not only remains low, but continues to be reduced, and as you just said, it's below the national average. What kind of message is that sending to teachers, to parents, to students in the chairs in front of the teachers who are not making any money, that bricks and mortar are worth investing in, but the people teaching are not?
Well, Mike, again, you know, I think that's an unfair comparison, and it makes it seem, again, like there's an either-or.
But there seems to be an either-or.
Well, you know, again, so let's look. First of all, capital construction is funded by the county, and the county provides funding for that. The majority of responsibility for teacher pay rests with the state. And so that's a state obligation. And so the county takes care of capital needs and then supplements teacher pay. But the majority of funding teacher salary resides with the state. And
but
so that is a state obligation.
What good is it if you have a sparkling new state-of-the-art school building and you have demoralized not very good teachers there because you can't attract the best teachers because you don't pay anything? What good is it?
Mike, remember, we've had 13,000 additional students over the last 6 years. We have aging facilities that if we don't upgrade them soon are not going to be safe for our students or our teachers. So this is, again, why it's not an either-or. We need to do both, and I think it really is unfair to the conversation to make it seem like we should do one rather than the other. Why is it that if we're going to say that education is important, if we understand that education is important to workforce development, if we're going to make a commitment to our young people, then why would we make it an either-or conversation? Remember, $290 million for capital construction for Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools compared to other schools our size is nowhere near close to what other schools are getting. So it's not a let's do one rather than the other. We have to do both. We need to do both. And we should be able to find the resolve to do both.
Okay. Now, you can't do anything about this. So I'm going to ask you an unfair question.
Okay, that's
fine.
You can't
do anything about this. As you say, the county provides for facilities and the state provides for teacher salaries. Who says it has to be that way? Why can't the county decide, well, the state's cheating us, the state is hurting us by not funding public education to the degree that we needed, we're being funded to where teacher salaries are below the national average, we're a growing and important city in North Carolina, education is important to the success of this city, and it can predict our attractiveness as a business area of the state and the survival of the city of Charlotte and the county of Mecklenburg. Let's do a bond issue for teacher salaries. Why can't they do that?
Well, I got a better question for you. Why not have the school board have taxing authority so that the school board can be held accountable for both capital construction and teacher salaries? The challenge for the school district is we have to go to the state to ask for funds. We have to go to the county to ask for funds. And so we are most accountable for the results. We're most accountable for the outputs. and we have almost no discretion and ability on our own to derive the inputs. And so we have the county, I think the last time I was on our show, a county commissioner called making a very passionate point that he believed that it was the responsibility of the state to fund teacher salaries and for the county commissioners to choose to go above the state salary schedule. Where I'm now hearing state legislators say that, well, if you look at the overall contribution in North Carolina to education, we're 11th highest. But again, that's because the state has assumed primary responsibility for funding education, and that has not been put on county. So however it gets worked out, whether the state says we're going to do it all, whether the county says we need to do more, whether it's the school board actually getting taxing authority where they can be held accountable. And if people don't like the decisions that are made with the money, then individuals on the school board would get voted out of office. But somewhere along the way, there has to be a responsibility for those who have the ability to fund adequately, and then hold those accountable for getting the results that we need for our children.
Laura on Facebook writes, what is being done to improve teacher morale? As a 16-year-old CMS parent and former employee, I'm deeply concerned we're placing unreasonable demands on teachers while expecting them to work as subsidized volunteers.
Yeah, so that has been something since I first came into Charlotte-Mecklenburg last year we spent a lot of time on. At the beginning of the year, we had a convocation, a pep rally for our teachers at the Time Warner Arena. That was a chance that we had to take, and we had talked to our teachers. Several teachers had talked about bringing everybody together, trying to motivate, trying to uplift after what people perceived to be a very difficult legislative session. That has been very well received. We continue to hear people say that was one of the best things that has happened in CMS in many years because it was all focused on uplifting our teachers. We're working with businesses, faith-based communities, civic groups to do things to help support our teachers, to let them know how valued they are, and we have to do more. I constantly believe that as superintendent, a big part of morale is making sure that our employees are well-informed, that they have a chance to have voice. And so we're constantly thinking about how we communicate, how we message. As we're creating our new strategic plan, there's an intense focus on engagement of our workforce and our teachers, making sure that they have voice in the direction of the school district. And then my job is to advocate and fight for teacher salaries. I have been very vocal about this since I first came into Charlotte-Mecklenburg. I will continue to be vocal about it. I will be vocal about it in Raleigh. I will be vocal about this with county commissioners. We have got to do better than what we're doing in North Carolina right now.
Let's move on to testing and test scores.
Sure.
Standardized test scores evidently tumbled last year, not just here but around the state. We know that less than half of North Carolina students were deemed proficient in most subjects, but parents, teachers, and students won't get the hard results of that until, I think, next month for the tests taken at the end of last year. Why the lag? We have computers now.
Yeah. Well, the state, as I'm sure you know, across the country there is the adoption of what is called the Common Core.
Right.
Over 42 states have agreed to take on this very rigorous set of standards that are designated to get students more college and career ready. Mm-hmm. And there are new assessments coming for those Common Core that are going to be some of the most aggressive, rigorous tests ever in the history of public education across our country. Last year, the state of North Carolina created new assessments to try to match what they believe will be similar to Common Core assessments, and then they created a cut score that they believe is more appropriate to the way Common Core is being assessed. We have not gotten those test results yet. They were taken in spring of last year. I believe it's been announced that they will come out sometime in November. That is through the prerogative of the State Department of Public Instruction as to when to release those test scores. But what we're seeing, what I believe is what's happened in every state so far, is it's done a similar thing where they've tried to create new assessments with a cut score that is much more rigorous. In New York and Kentucky, you've seen about a 20 to 30 point drop. And then students will adjust to this level of rigor, and it is appropriate. I'm a big believer that a rising tide lifts all ships, and so we've got to make our standards as rigorous as possible, but there will be an adjustment period.
So do you think that CMS results, when these are released in November, will mirror the state results, that we will see the public school performance drop because of these new standards because they've changed the scoring system?
Well, so, you know, when people say, and I always try to say, when people say, what do they mean by cut score? If you look at it this way, if you were running a mile, okay, and you were running it under 4 minutes, and that was the standard, the expectation that you're going to run the mile in 4 minutes, then if all of a sudden you change it, and so now you're running a mile, and the expectation is that you're going to run it in 3 minutes, okay, that's really what has happened. That's the equivalent of changing a cut score. It's gone from you're still running a mile, but instead of running it in 4 minutes, you got to run it in 3 minutes. And so it's going to take people to adopt that. If it was 4 minutes before, you're going to have to figure out who are those kids that got close to 3 minutes, and you got to boost them up. You got to have to do targeted things to get those students that were far away from the 4 minutes. Now it's 3 minutes. So that cut score becomes important. So I believe Charlotte-Mecklenburg school results will mirror what happens in the state. What we've seen this year is when the state released graduation rates, the entire state went up. We went up more than the state. When the SAT results were announced recently, they increased for the state. Charlotte-Mecklenburg's went up even higher than the state's. I hope if we do drop, it will not be as precipitous as the state drop, but we'll just have to see.
The yardstick has changed, and according to preliminary information about these test score results, only 45% of fourth graders were deemed proficient in reading, with the biggest drop in eighth grade math under the old system. 80% of eighth graders were deemed proficient in math. Under the new system, only 35% are. So which is the more accurate yardstick?
Well, I think it depends. If you know, there's two ways I've always said to close achievement gaps. Okay, you can lower the bar and have more kids jump over, so you feel good because the you can say more students are meeting the standard, but you've lowered the standard. I'm not a believer in that. I'm a believer in what is an appropriate standard. When we talk about college and career ready, what is a standard that if a student learns that material, they will be ready for the workforce, they're going to be ready to go to college without remediation. So I'm a big believer in high standards, and there's an adjustment period because like any change where you create a higher standard. When you create a higher standard in your workplace, there's an adjustment period where for a while people are struggling to match that new expectation. But you know what? When we bet on our kids with more rigor, they very rarely let us down. And when you put a great teacher in the classroom, that's the best driver to meet those standards. So what I'm concerned about is it's great that we're going to raise the level of rigor, but if we don't address our teachers and their pay and making sure that we're doing everything we can to have a quality teacher in the classroom, that's going to inhibit us to be able to address increase in those student performance on those new standards.
How many teachers do you think you've lost because of the pay issue? How many teachers, good teachers, do you think you have not been able to attract because of this pay issue?
You know, we're looking at that right now. What I want to do is to be very clear about that because I don't want to just put information out there and rattle the saber and then not be accurate. Prior to that, we were not asking those specific questions. You know, are you leaving because of changes in state legislation? Are you leaving because of purely salaries? And so part of what we now have initiated is an exit survey, and we're really trying to make sure that when a teacher does leave, especially to go to another state, that we're following up to ask that question. But I've had conversations with several teachers who said, you know, Dr. Morrison, I love CMS. I love CMS. I love my school. I have loved teaching in North Carolina, but I've got to go to a state that respects education more, and they're going to South Carolina.
Well, you just got back from San Diego this morning where you were at a conference.
Yes.
You were the keynote speaker, and they wanted to know from you what the heck is going on in North Carolina because we used to be known as the education state.
You know, again, for many, many years, as there was an examination of which states were really getting education reform and initiatives right, again, not that it was perfect and not that there wasn't need to improve. Of course there was needs to improve. But North Carolina was viewed as a state that really, in terms of return on investment, did not fund education like when I was in Maryland. And Maryland was one of the highest funding states in the country. So there was a lot of resources provided with an expectation of a lot of quality outputs. But North Carolina has been replicated, discussed. The brand of public education in North Carolina has been very strong. And I think now there are some questions about is that going to continue.
You talked about adding the A to STEM, making it STEAM. And the reason for that is because the arts help prepare creative thinkers for the job force of the 21st century. Teachers complain about having to teach to the tests, the various tests that students now take, and there are an enormous number of tests that have to be taken and given by teachers now. Experts know that tomorrow's workforce has to be able to think creatively. How do you test that on a multiple-choice test? That seems to be the antithesis of preparing a student for the 21st century workforce.
Mike, that is right what I'm saying out there as well. I am very committed to accountability. I believe that there's an appropriate amount of testing that has to happen. We want to be able to tell a parent, yes, your child can read at grade level. Yes, your student is progressing to be ready for college. But there's an appropriate amount of testing to allow for a significant amount of quality teaching. And one of the things I really rail against are the way that we're testing and what we're testing. And so to your point, when we know that creativity, entrepreneurship, collaboration, communication. These are the skills that are going to be important to the workforce of tomorrow. Doing multiple choice assessments and short answer are not going to get us to be able to say that we really are preparing our kids for college and career readiness. And so we continue to be fascinated in our state with the proliferation of testing. Many of the tests that we're giving are not assessing what a child knows and is able to do, but simply to tell us an indication of what we think is a measure of the teacher effectiveness.
Exactly. Is there a better way to do that?
Because absolutely,
there's
a better.
It seems to me that's unfair to the teacher. There are too many variables. You cannot judge, it seems to me. This is my opinion. I'm going to give my opinion on this.
All right, let's have your
opinion. For
once in
my life.
How about that?
You cannot judge a teacher exclusively on how a child does in the classroom. There are too many variables. So how do you judge them fairly?
I think absolutely. I think any teacher is going to say, I assume responsibility for the education of the children in my classroom. But it has to be on multiple measures. To have one test at one time where we doubt the validity of the test, we don't know how that test is put into a mechanism to create a teacher evaluation effectiveness score, I think those are the things that I hear from our teachers. They're not even opposed to having some component of their overall evaluation be measured on student testing, but anybody in any industry wants their performance to be measured on multiple measures. And so if we're going to use testing, let's make sure they're quality tests, that they're measuring the right things, that they tell us fundamentally, first of all, what our children are knowing and able to do, and then we can get to some of the other things. But doing tests in the way we're doing it is simply, it is not effective, it is not efficient, it's not cost effective either, and the amount of time it takes out of instruction is obscene.
Well, here's an interesting comment that I didn't know the governor made until yesterday. Governor McCrory told the State Chamber of Commerce that teachers have become test proctors and that we need to slow down and regroup with all these tests and let our teachers teach.
Yeah, I was very appreciative. Several large urban school district superintendents a few months ago met with Governor McCrory. He was very interested in this topic, and he's been very vocal about his concerns about the proliferation of testing and the type of testing. Recently, myself, the state superintendent of schools, the education advisor to the governor, and several superintendents went to go see the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, with our concerns about this very topic to see if we could get some relief from federally mandated tests. So I think we're starting to have that conversation. And again, it's not a lack of accountability. It's not, you know, there has to be some tests, but let's make sure they're quality tests and that there's not so many that teachers don't have time to teach.
I have 30 seconds. The third grade students this year will be held back if they can't read at grade level. And
right.
I know that the system has made changes to ensure that as few as possible third graders will be held back.
Right.
Is it too early to tell how that is going?
Well, again, they're going to be measured on the new assessments that we have not yet gotten the test results back, so we can look at how we've done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
We've had about over 70 to 80% of our students reading at grade level. We suspect that that will drop somewhat with the new test, so we'll have to do some extended learning opportunities for those students.
Dr. Heath Morrison, superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, thanks for the hour.
Thanks for having me on.